Hey, everybody. Welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I am your host, Jarrell Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. You can guess the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. Be sure to follow the podcast as well on Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast to get updates on the episodes from when they release. And if you have a question or if you have a guitarist that you think would be really great to have on the show for me to interview, to speak with, always fascinated in finding, people's stories and origins, if you will. So feel free to direct message me on Instagram, or you can go to the 440 podcast@gmail.com to send me a direct email. You can do that as well. We can try to connect the dots there. So feel free to do that if you would like to do so. And today I'm very excited. I had the great opportunity via the algorithm gods of Instagram connected me with this guitarist. Just to give a little bit of a brief bio here. This is a Grammy nominated guitarist, composer, and arranger. Began his musical studies since the age of 15, rapidly demonstrating a natural ability to play and compose. After studying classical guitar and composition at Brooklyn Conservatory of Music in 1986, played local gigs in New York. Fine-tuned his education with many talented folks and earned a bachelor's degree from the New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music in 2008, master's degree at Juilliard in 2010. And if you've seen him play, in whether live or via video, you can see just the real beautiful music that's coming out of this guy's fingers. And I'm excited to speak to him, the 440 Guitar Podcast. Very excited to have Top Guarna on the show. How you doing, man?
Good, man. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Of course, of course. I know we were talking about the weather a little bit off air. That seems like we're a little bit of gloom on your end, and then a little bit of heat on my end, right?
Yeah, it's a little overcast here, but that, you know, it's fine. It's all good. It's not raining, but it looks like it may. But it's good.
Yeah. I dig the posters, man. You got some greats up there. I got a few behind me myself, but. Is that Thelonious next to
yeah,
Hendrix?
That's Monk, and then I'll just
okay.
And then there's some Hendrix. There's nice. Just like the Hendrix corner. There's a clock, a Hendrix clock.
And oh, nice.
A couple
nice.
Of things, and then there's a Steely Dan there.
Oh, okay, that's who that was.
Coltrane in the corner, yeah. And then just got to have Charlie Christian up there,
great.
Up at the top there.
Classic.
My wife Catherine. Got me these posters, and we put them up around. This is my practice room, so I have this stuff up here for inspiration. So every time I'm I have no excuse. There's greatness all around me up here, so it's like
very cool. that's great. So on the 440 Guitar Podcast, really big on origin stories, how people got to where they are today. So I guess just to start it off, one of the questions I like to ask my guests is, tell me about your earliest memory of music.
Well, my earliest memory of music is my dad. My dad was a semi-professional musician, worked a day job and driving like a delivery truck, like in the tri-state area around New York. But he was really into music, and he was into guitars, into all the great guitar players, just regardless of genre. I mean, he was everything from like Hendrix to Jimmy Page to Roy Buchanan to Joe Pass to, it was just all over the map. So my earliest memories really are, if we didn't have something going on with the family, my dad would come home from work. We'd have dinner together. He'd go up in his practice room. He would, have the turntable going. He'd have tunes on, and he'd be like figuring out and transcribing tunes from the turntable. And man, I'd go to bed and I'd wake up to go to school, and he'd still be in the room working on stuff, and then get in the shower and then go to his day job. He was just really into it. So that's my earliest memories. It was watching him play and just spend a lot of time in that room just working on music, and guitar playing.
So needless to say, a lot of music was played around the house, literally played and then just kind of on the old vinyl player, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Nice. Absolutely.
Nice. Man. And then as far as kind of like that experience, you know, when did it kind of connect with you where you were like, you know, maybe I should try this. Was it something that he kind of like, it's like kind of just like, was like, hey, like you should try this too. Or is that something that you picked up yourself or?
You know, it was kind of like some of my earliest memories. So, you know, I think from what I was told when I was like 4 or 5, I don't remember this. I kind of gravitated to it and I started kind of like sneaking into the room and noodling on the guitars and everything. But I wasn't serious and I was a baby. So, you know, then after that, it was like hanging out with my friends and going to school. And so music, I never really got too deep into it, but it was always around. But once I got to like, you know, going from junior high school into high school, I got really into it. I just got the bug, you know. My dad was still going at it. He would take me to band rehearsals sometimes, like if my mom was busy and there was no one to watch me or something, and he had a band rehearsal, he'd cart me along to the band rehearsal and I would hang out with all these people and, you know, listen to him play and everything. But I would say probably around, you know, 14, 15, like right in that area is when I really started to say, hey, I'm really interested in that. I started bugging him to show me some tunes and things. And then, you know, subsequently, like my friends also got into music too around that time. One started playing bass. The other one was, one of my friends was already playing drums. So that kind of just led me even more down the road, you know, to playing and taking it a little bit more serious. And then once I was actually in high school, it was like, you know, I was already playing a little bit and figuring out tunes and starting to play in my first bands, you know, at that point.
And were those rock bands? Because I know like you had a lot of like jazz influence very early, you know, probably, you know, amongst other genres in the house.
I mean, although like some of the jazz players were being played in the house, like Joe Pass in particular, Tony Mottola, you know, a guitar player, that's not what I gravitated to. I was gravitating towards the music that my friend, we were all listening to. So it was like, it was rock. It was like, first it was rock. It was like Zeppelin, Hendrix, Sabbath. You know, those are my earliest things. I was totally into that stuff and working on that stuff all the time. The jazz stuff came later for me, like for my passion for it came later, I should say. But then I started getting into funk, you know, Tower Power, Parliament Funkadelic. I was listening to all kinds of Motown and R&B too and playing all of that stuff. But jazz came later. It wasn't the first thing.
Nice. Now, given, you know, the influences and just hearing a lot of these players, you know, very early and then, you know, the rock players at, you know, kind of more so when you know, we're starting to play with the band and other people and stuff. Are there any particular artists that kind of, that stand out to you as far as like, you know, it's like you remember a lot of other musicians, but like this, something about this guy connected me as far as like to continue playing the instrument. Do you remember anything like that as far as any certain?
Well, Hendrix was an early one for sure. Yeah. You know, Hendrix, Jimmy Page, those were like the earliest ones for me that were like really inspiring. And then one guy that I was into, and I wasn't really particularly into the music so much, but the guitar playing that always knocked me out was Uli Roth from the Scorpions. I just, that guy was like a combination of Hendrix and like some neoclassical stuff before that was really happening. We're talking like, you know, 77, even earlier, like early to mid 70s. And he was just playing some really advanced stuff. So he was one of the earlier guys that knocked me out. But man, when I was in high school and a mutual friend turned me on to Alan Holdsworth, that was it. That just sent me into a complete tailspin. Yeah. Never heard anything like that in my life, you know? And that was like, boom, I was just like, all right. Then I started going down the rabbit hole. And even though like Alan's playing and his music is more electric, that kind of sent me like finding, you know, getting into more of the fusion stuff. I started getting into Return of Forever and, you know, Weather Report and various people and then working backwards, you know, and then getting into like you know, listening to Coltrane and Ellington and Monk, you know, but I was in, I went from rock to the fusion thing and then worked backwards, you know, like started going, you know, listening to Coltrane and then working back from there, Miles, Duke Ellington, Monk, Elmo Hope. I mean, I just, you know, it's a long list.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny you mentioned Alan Holdsworth. I've been kind of like looking at a lot of videos of him, and there's a guy on YouTube where he like transcribed, I guess, like a lot of his stuff recently. And he has like a 3 to 5 hour video kind of explaining some of the stuff that he was doing, I guess, in his music. Just such an interesting guy, you know. And then the fact that I think he was a violin player before he started to play guitar. Yeah, but just like his brain. I'm like, how he thought through certain things and how he did some of those things, and then even like how he named some of the chords or scales. He's like, this doesn't make sense to anybody, but it makes sense to me. You know, so
that's kind of one of the things that make him unique, is his, you know, perspective on, you know, what the music theory is, how he, what his relationship to that stuff is, you know. What I mean, he's a true person who, like, he did it his way.
Yeah,
you know. What I mean. And you can hear it.
Right. Exactly. Now you went to school for music. What type of experience was that experience? Cause I would imagine, you know, when you're going to a conservatory or something like that, it's definitely a different type of monster, right? I mean, you have a certain type of discipline. I would imagine there's just a few of those moments where there's like, you know, you're damn near probably falling asleep practicing or just stressed out. I mean, give me some kind of highlight moments as far as just some of the things you remember going through that.
Well, my musical path is, you know, it's kind of like really took a lot of like twists and turns. I mean, I would imagine as many people, you know, like I was saying before, I grew up playing rock and then I got into the fusion thing, you know, Chick Corea, you know, Holdsworth, all of this stuff and playing. And that was all throughout high school. Mm-hmm. And then when I really, like, you know, when it was time to start thinking about, well, what am I going to be doing after high school? I was already playing in clubs and bands and stuff all throughout high school. Oh, wow. You know, I was pretty active playing, you know. And so a few of my mutual musician friends who I wasn't necessarily playing in bands with, but we just had a relationship, a personal relationship, they were going to school for classical music. So I decided, well, let me try this, you know, let me check it out. So I think I remember like being a senior in high school and I'd never played classical guitar before. And I just wound up convincing my parents to buy me like a classical guitar. And I got a teacher and I practiced, you know, the basic repertoire, you know, the Carcassi, the Fernando Sor, all the entry level stuff that someone, you know, starts to learn when they're playing classical guitar. And I just went crazy, you know, hours and hours. And I got into Brooklyn Conservatory of Music, which at the time I had no idea. It was a Juilliard satellite program. There was all the teachers from Juilliard. I mean, I got to be around Itzhak Perlman. I used to page turn for Itzhak Perlman's rehearsals when I was in between classes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't even really know how heavy these cats were, you know, at the time I was in school. I know that I studied with Robert Starr, who's a pretty well-known composer, and Noah Krashevsky and Robert Dodge, who was one of the pioneers of electronic music. I had no idea who I was around. But I knew it was a really seriously demanding program. Mm. And the guitar program was being run by a really great guitarist named Michael Cedric Smith. And he was a concert guitarist at the time, and he had ties to Julian Bream, William Kanan Geiser. I mean, just real heavy guys who were on the classical guitar concert scene. And he used to bring them in to do master classes. Mm. And so I was really into it for a while, but I did realize, like, about 2.5 years into that program, that I like too much other music. I want to be doing, if I was going to stay in that program, it was so demanding because there were people from all over the world, Israel, you know, China. They were flying in to be classical guitar players. That's what they were pursuing for their life. And I realized that that's not my true passion. So I couldn't continue with it anymore. So I actually left school about 2.5 years, probably almost made it to my junior year. And I decided to go to Musicians Institute in California for multiple reasons. I mean, Joe Pass was out there at the time. Scott Henderson was out there at the time. Wow. There was a bunch of really great guitar players that I just kind of wanted to rub elbows with at the time. Yeah. And it was good for me because I had no family, no friends. I knew no one out there. And I knew, okay, man, like this is going to be the time for me where I'm going to really be able to isolate myself and practice and get my basics and all this stuff together. And that's what I did. But without being too long-winded about the whole Brooklyn Conservatory thing, when I look back on it now, and man, I just stepped in it. I was so lucky that, wow. I mean, the foundations that I built, even music theory, ear training, orchestration, yeah. all that stuff was really like solidified early from me because it was really demanding, you know, and that made learning other types of music from like, at least from an intellectual level, theoretically made it a little bit easier for me because I had a pretty solid foundation. Stylistically, of course, you still have to go in and learn the vocabulary, and that's the hard part, and transcribe all that stuff. But theoretically, I was getting it quick.
Yeah.
You know?
That's wild. I was going to ask you, too, that journey between from you doing the rock stuff and the clubs and whatnot, and then transitioning to classical. Was there, like, how was that transition from you just playing in general? Because I feel like a lot of players, you know, it's like sometimes we'll pick up these bad habits, you know, and then when we're switching to more of a formal type of instruction, you're like, oh, I'm supposed to be doing this. I'm not, you know, I'm holding this wrong or I'm picking this wrong. How was that experience as far as that type of transition, or did it kind of flow? Well, did it kind of flow well as far as for when you went from, you know, point A to point B?
That's a good question. I have to try to think about that. I think I was lucky in the sense that, you know, transitioning from playing electric guitar to classical guitar, one of the things was obviously right hand technique, all this stuff, which I didn't have much of because I've been playing with a pick all that time.
Yeah.
But I really hooked up with a really good classical teacher who was pretty accomplished, you know, at least locally in the New York area. So when I told him what my goal was about getting into Brooklyn Conservatory, which was Brooklyn College at the time, he kind of really steered me in the right direction, showed me exactly what I needed to do. You know, obviously, I mean, I was only as good as I could be practicing for a year. You know what I mean? But I was lucky enough, I think, where I got myself to a level where I could play the pieces, the entry level pieces that I needed to play to get the audition, you know, and get accepted. Yeah. And I think also maybe, it was partially the people who were at my audition, who were the jurors, saw potential, like how serious I was, you know, 'cause I was no way near what some of these guys coming in were like, 'cause that's all they did their whole life since they were 4 and 5 years old. You know what I mean? I was nowhere near that. So, in that sense, I mean, I guess to answer your question, I was steered in the right direction. I wasn't highly accomplished, but I didn't find it completely difficult. I just wasn't really advanced at it.
Okay.
So, you know, I did work on it, you know. It was a lot of work, you know.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, that's a huge, to me, that's a huge accomplishment as far as like going from, you know, that to classical, you know, and being able to, you know, to hang in there and to pick it up and, you know, and people see, oh, okay, I see this guy, like he's, you know.
I mean, I enjoyed it. That's what drove me. That's what, you know, with most people who become good at anything, you know, you do it because you really enjoy it. You love to do it. That's what drives you to do it. Absolutely. I mean, I remember like spending hours and hours and hours, you know, trying to keep up with these other guitar players in the program and working on my stuff, but I would always be moonlighting. There was like 4 or 5 guys in the program who were like into jazz too. And I remember, you know, one guy was a tenor saxophone player and they would have these little jam sessions in the cafeteria and we'd play like Impressions or like, you know, Maiden Voyage or something. And I had no idea, you know, I was just, that's really the first time I actually started kind of moonlighting, playing a little bit of jazz, you know, but once that started to happen, though, you know, I started to realize, okay, there's a rub here. Like, I love doing this classical thing, but I don't see myself doing it for my career.
Right.
You know? And definitely. That's when it started to, like, I started to have to think about what's the next move for me.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask you, as far as, like, your journey with, you know, when it comes to, like, music theory and obviously, like, reading music and writing music, like, how was that process learning at that particular time? You know, because like you said, you know, a lot of these guys, even just from a playing perspective, a lot of these people were doing this from at a very young age. So, right. You know, when it comes to like reading music and whatnot, especially when it comes to guitar and whatnot, you know, that type of arrangement, was that something that you felt that it was like, was there any type of struggle picking that up, or how was that experience? Because I would imagine, just for myself, like, as far as, oh man, like, this is a different monster, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, my dad was a self-taught musician. He didn't read music. Mm. And I didn't come from reading music. I was always about sitting down with the recordings and figuring out everything by ear.
Yeah.
But that one teacher that I was referencing, I remember his name was Lou Manzi. Mm. And he was referred to me by a friend of mine who was playing classical guitar. He started me reading right away. He's like, you want to get into the school, man, you got to have your reading together. Hmm. So, you know, I started, that was it. I mean, there was no way around it. It was like every day I'd be doing an hour and a half to 2 hours a day of reading.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
For that year. So that helped me start to get my reading together. But yeah, it was a struggle. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, you have to want it. You know, it's right. That's something you got to do every day in the beginning, at least, you know, to get it going.
Definitely.
You know,
definitely.
So yeah, it was a struggle.
Definitely. Yeah. It's interesting too. Like thinking about some of these amazing musicians and a lot of them were self-taught, you know, like Alan Holdsworth was self-taught, at least from a guitarist standpoint, you know what I mean? So it's, you know, some of the, you know, the Wes Montgomerys and whatnot, and just kind of hearing that and seeing, and I feel like there's a lot of musicians where guitarists where, you know, some of their favorite musicians end up being a lot of these guys that are self-taught versus like formally trained and whatnot. There just seems to be a very interesting, I don't know, just kind of how that story is put together as far as, you know, when it comes to just, you know, like, oh yeah, this guy, or like for people that are classically trained or taught or instruction wise, some of their favorite players end up being people that's kind of had to figure out the instrument. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just find that to be a fascination, you know, just in general. Cause for me, I know I'm a self-taught, you know, musician, kind of just picked it up, you know, and just, you know, like you said, you have to want it. So just those hours in your bedroom or whatever, you know? So, but, I just think that just that type of learning where you have to figure this out, you know, is really interesting, you know?
Well, for me, you know, I consider myself self-taught because all those formative years, I mean, it was all exactly what we're talking about, sitting down with recordings. I mean, it would take me 2 hours to learn two bars of music or three hours to learn one riff or something sometimes in the beginning, you know what I mean? But the way, you know, obviously now in retrospect, I look back at it and I'm like, I think that's one of the reasons why all the formal training I had later on came to me quick, because I was already hearing those sounds. And then now people were telling me what those sounds were called.
Mm.
So I'd say, oh, that's that. That's from this tune, or that's from this tune. And it started to really kind of, I was able to start piecing those things together. Like, I've heard that before. I know that sound. Had no idea what it was called.
Right.
I can play the chord or the voicing.
Right.
But what is this thing? I don't know what this thing is. And later, that was like, no, that's what that is. So I started now to associate what I was hearing with what it was called formally and how it's functioning. Mm. You know. So I think for me, coming from that direction was much more beneficial than being formally trained and not having just self-taught. Right. You know what I mean? Right. So that way, I think that's the better way to go for me. you know?
Yeah. Like, you know, definitely different for different people. But yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with you, because I feel like you got a lot of, I've called it like battleground training, as far as like you were playing with people live, you know, like before all of that. And I feel like my philosophy is always, you know, like if you're not playing music live, like it has to be played live to some capacity. That's really when it counts, you know, for at least in my brain. But I wanted to talk about your playing in general, because, you know, when I see you play, there's just a very, you're very calm. How you move through the fretboards, this feels very fluid, very musical. And one of the things that I'm always trying to do as a guitar player, just playing live in general, is like letting the music flow through you, you know, and not think about it. And with you having so much knowledge, and even from like the theory stuff, the jazz stuff, the classical stuff, and then playing live, you know, even like in like your jazz quartets, or just playing live in general, you know, I guess my question is, like, how do you, do you have any particular type of philosophy when you're playing live, or just playing through the fretboard, like just trying not to overthink as far as playing, or just kind of like learning the tunes and then just really, you know, letting yourself just, you know, play without overthinking? I guess like for someone who's playing live, but trying to play and not overthink, like what would you say is some of your, what would be your philosophy if you were to tell someone like that?
Well, first off, thanks for all those
kind words. Of course.
I appreciate that. I mean, you know, obviously, Van, like when any musician, in my opinion, is playing at their best and at the highest level musically, you know, you're serving the call. The music is calling. Mm. You're serving the calling. So you're really not thinking, you know, and that's, you know, that doesn't always happen all the time, though. So at least for me, sometimes I have to kind of restrict myself, put restrictions on myself. For instance, like, you know, I'll play a tune one night and I'll feel like I really got a piece of it, like I really got inside of it. And I didn't think about anything at all. Mm. I was just playing, wow. You know, and it just was there. But as a performer, when you're performing, you know, hundreds of gigs, hundreds and hundreds, you're on stage so many times and you're playing, that's not always going to be the case. That's what you're striving for, you know, ultimately, in my opinion, that's what you're striving for, not to think, to rely on all the hours of practice and all the things that you've been working on to kind of just manifest, be in the moment and make the music happen. But sometimes that doesn't happen. Actually, quite often it doesn't happen. So, you know, when I see really great musicians playing, you know, and have growing up in New York, I had the luxury of growing up in New York. I was born in Brooklyn, and I was did my teens in, you know, Staten Island, but I always had access to Manhattan. So I was seeing my idols all the time. I was sneaking out to clubs and seeing Scofield, and I saw Holdsworth and, you know, in the 80s and, you know, all kinds of Jim Hall, all kinds of people. And one of the things that I noticed, one of the things that I noticed, I mean, I saw Segovia, but anyway, one of the things I noticed is, especially in an improvising gig, the people who are improvising, sometimes you could tell it's like they were thinking about something. You know, maybe it just kind of wasn't flowing so easily. So they were thinking about something and, you know, working through that. And at least for me, when I'm in that space where I feel like it isn't completely flowing, I'll restrict myself. I'll say, okay, well, I'm going to execute maybe this idea, this harmonic idea here. And that's going to be my germ. Mm. And let's just see where that goes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And kind of just not over-intellectualize it, but give myself a starting point where I could inspire myself maybe to. And, you know, like I said, at the best nights, that doesn't happen at all. It just flows. But sometimes it doesn't, you know?
Yeah, man, those are special moments, you know, where it's just like, because, yeah, I remember I worked on an album. I released an album not too long ago, and my friend who also played bass for me, we were in the studio and he played some of his best riffs on bass. I mean, he's a guitar player too, but he played bass for me, but he played some of his best bass playing. And he was like, wasn't really thinking, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. But it was just the energy between all of us and it being a room of not like feeling overpressured, like, okay, let's just try it again, you know, and just him really being into the music, you know, yeah. Me listening back, I'm like, holy crap, he's destroying, you know, and he interviewed me on an episode about our experience. And I was like, you did some of your best work there. And he was like, yeah, like, I wasn't even thinking about it, you know what I mean? So I was just like, wow, that's amazing, you know?
Yeah, you just hope that all of your preparation, you know, your practice and your preparation, you know, manifests itself. You know, someone told me something, and I can't remember who it was, unfortunately, but it was an elder musician, you know, told me, hey, man, practice what you want to sound like on the gigs. Practice what you want to sound like on the gigs. And at first I really didn't, you know, you just think, oh, I'm practicing all these licks and I'm practicing all these things and this is what I want to sound like. And it's like, when I started really thinking about what he said, like, you know, I was like, okay, it's not just about what you're playing. It's about how I'm playing. It's about the delivery, you know, it's like an actor or something. When they deliver a line, you know, it has to come off a certain way. It's not just about the words, you know, and how that relates to our music is our notes. It's not just about the notes, but how it's being, you know, what does the time feel? You know, how does this feel? How is articulation? All these very little minute details that in the end is what the presentation is to the listener. Right. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And as a musician, sometimes you're just so wrapped up in your own thing that your perspective about what you're playing is not really what it sounds like outside, you know, in the audience. So one of the things, at least for me, was always recording myself, even on this, even on the cell phone, man. Take the cell phone, just put it down somewhere and listen back to it. And it's like hearing yourself speak, you know, it's like, ah, you cringe, you know. But after a while, you're like, I like that on the, you know, while I was on the gig, I thought that wasn't good, but actually that sounds good. And all the stuff that I thought was good, that needs to come out. That doesn't sound right, you know? So it's about editing, you know, and all that stuff too.
Great advice. Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit about your latest work. I'm sure you're probably working on a bunch of other stuff too, but I believe the album's called Spirit Science.
Yeah,
really great work. I was listening to a couple of the songs there, and I was like, "Wow, this is really incredible stuff." Tell me a little bit as far as that experience working on that, you know, that album.
That record was my second recording for a really cool label called Destiny Music. The record I did before that was called. Oh my gosh, I'm totally spacing out on this right now. What was it called? Oh, The Wishing Stones. But Spirit Science, I've been working on, you know, I guess it came out in November or September of 2020, right before COVID.
Yeah.
So the unfortunate thing was that it was because of COVID, it didn't get a whole lot of attention. You know, and I didn't have a chance to tour for it. I still haven't. I think I've done one live gig promoting that music, you know, and that was released in 2020. Right. So, but the inspiration for that record was I started getting turned on to sacred geometry and, you know, the study of science and spirituality and, you know, geometric shapes and how you see this in nature and all that stuff. And I just bought a few books and my wife saw that I was into it and she bought me a few other books. And I really thought it was an inspiring topic for me. And so I started thinking about, well, these shapes and these symbols, you know, if they were in musical form, what would it sound like? And that's kind of what inspired the writing on there. You know, that's my interpretation of what I think some of these symbols and these things would sound like.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's funny because without understanding the context of the title, when I saw your title, I immediately thought of Love Supreme because Coltrane's very, you know, he's a very spiritual person. And then, you know, he always talk, there's a really good book that I read about him and the experience working on it, and where they were saying that when he was playing, he found himself getting closer to God as they were playing and as doing this improv stuff, you know, and to me, that reminds me of that kind of a spirit scientific thing in the sciences is the, you know, the crazy theory that they're doing and the keeping together and all the music stuff. But then behind that, there's a spiritual connection that he has and that energy in the room. So like, so it's funny that, you know, reading that name of your album, I merely thought of that. So that's funny. Yeah. That's funny.
Wow. You know. Well, thanks for mentioning it in the same breath, because that's yeah. But you know, it's you know, the whole spirit science is another name for what's called sacred geometry. Mm. It's amazing how all of those, if you ever get a chance to read on the topic, how it is so closely related to music, how it is music. Mm. You know, it's really incredible. You know.
Wow. Wow. Were there any favorite or any highlighted moments of like certain specific songs that you made for the album that was like, oh man, I remember when we had to do this and this and turned out really well? Any particular songs on the record that?
Yeah, there's two. One is the song Platonic Solids. Mm. That's one of my favorite songs on the record. I mean, as far as recording and playing it, it was basically, I think we did one take. I think we did pretty much one or two takes of everything.
Oh, wow.
Period. We rehearsed one day before, and then we recorded the next day. And we, with the exception of one song, we didn't do more than two takes of anything. But wow. Platonic Solids was something that I was really happy with, not just from a compositional standpoint, but just especially the way everyone played, like an Aaron Parks, if you're familiar with Aaron, the keyboard piano player, he did some synthesizer stuff and combined with Rhodes, and just the texture of that song combined with the groove, I was really, really happy with it. Mm. The other one that stands out is Two Circles. Mm. And I really like the way that turned out. But why that stands out to me is because when I wrote the song and I arranged it, I had the piano doing all the stuff that the guitar wound up doing. Mm. I reversed the roles. And when we actually went in to record it, I just hated the way it sounded. We did four takes and it just wasn't working, man. It wasn't working. And I was like, there's a good song in here. So we got through most of the first day recording. Actually, we recorded 2 days. I was wrong about that. We rehearsed one day, recorded 2 days. Mm. But that's the one song we got to in the first day that just sucked all the life out of us. You know what I mean? Like we just couldn't, it just wasn't working. It was the arrangement. So I was like, all right, guys, let's move on. We moved on to another tune. We recorded that. I went home that night and I rearranged. I stood up all night and I rearranged the whole song. I said, the guitar is playing this, doesn't sound right. I got to do this. The piano player's got to do this. Mm. And I just started rearranging the whole song. And then we went in the next day and just knocked it out in one take, and it just worked.
Yeah, so it kind of turned out to be kind of like a math problem where you're like, you know what, something's going to happen. I got to rewrite this, you know. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because it's like, okay, you know, you arrange a song and you go and you put it in your Sibelius or your Finale or whatever. And like, okay, man, this sounds good. But when you get with real instruments, you get with real people in the room and the groove's happening and the air is in the room, and it just sometimes it just doesn't work out the way you think it's going to work out.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Exactly. And I knew there was a good song in there. So I was like, I'm staying up all night. I got to fix what I thought was wrong with it, and it actually worked.
Man, very cool. Very cool. Man, well, I guess one of the last things I wanted to ask you, you know, what are some things that you're working on right now? Is there anything, are you planning on kind of continuing to promote Spirit Science, or is there a new project you're working on people can look forward to?
Yes, there's, I mean, right now, I am trying to do some promotion, do some gigs and some touring for Spirit Science. Although I've moved on, I'm writing for a new project, which I'll talk about in a moment. I at least want to bring this music live to a few different venues,
yeah.
You know? So I'm trying to do that. I think as of right now, in early 2023, I'll be doing a West Coast tour in February.
Oh, cool.
You know, starting probably either, I'm not sure where it's going to start, but it's going to be, you know, Southern California up to Portland, Oregon. Nice. And it's going to be like the middle of February. And nice. That'll be dedicated to Spirit Science music. I'm working on a new project called the Reimagine Trio. And that's with a great organist named Pat Bianchi, who was Pat Martino's organ player for the last, wow. I don't know, I guess 10 or 15 years, wow. And a really great drummer named Jason Tiemann, who's here in New York. And I'm doing some writing and arranging for that project. It's going to be an organ trio. So that's going to be the next thing that's coming out. I'm working with Oteil Burbridge, the bass player from Dead & Company, and who played with the Allman Brothers as well. And we're doing a Jerry Garcia ballads record. I'm going to plan a bunch of those tunes, and that's going to happen in November. Wow. And a couple other things I'm working on right now. I'm working on arranging and transcribing an Alan Holdsworth tribute record. I've already spoken to Jimmy Herring about it, so it's going to be a two guitar record.
Oh my God! I'm such a huge fan of Jimmy Herring. That's crazy.
Hopefully Jimmy is. We'll be able to work out everyone's schedule. It's so far the idea and the people I've spoken to, it's been me, Jimmy Herring, Oteil is going to play bass, and Omar Hakim is, I've spoken to him about playing drums. And I've already started arranging a few tunes for two guitars and transcribing them and stuff. So I'm hoping that's going to happen. Phenomenal. That's something that I'm going to pursue a little later this year. And the only other thing on top of that's going to happen is I've been playing with this great piano player named Donald Vega, who is the piano player for Ron Carter's trio. And so he's working on a new record that I'll be a part of. And hopefully it's going to be myself, Donald Vega, Ron Carter, and Lenny White.
Wow. That's
and so those are projects that are rolling along for next year. That's kind of what's on deck, you know?
Yeah, that's some great stuff there, man. Wow. Well, I'm excited for you. You definitely got to let me know when you're touring for Spirit Science around the SoCal area, see if I can try to get out there to support.
Fingers crossed, man. I'll be out there. I'm hoping to bring this music out there, you know?
Cool. Very awesome. Well, Tom Gorin, this is a really great opportunity. I'm really grateful for speaking with you, man. So thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, man. I appreciate you having me, really. It's been a really great time. Thank you.
Of course. I'm glad. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell here on the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon, and have a good day.